This is the Education Gadfly Show.
If she was more like Jason Bourne, it would be quite literal.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Jason Bourne of Education Reform, Robert Fundisio.
That kind of associates me with Matt Damon. I'm not sure I'm okay with that.
Well, right. And his views on education.
His mother attacks me relentlessly.
What's her name?
Forgive me. I can't recall her name. Childhood. No. Nancy. And I can't remember her last name. She's the early childhood person that every time I dare to opine on early childhood ed, she comes out of the woodwork and comes after me.
But see, you say she comes out of the woodwork and comes after you. If she was more like Jason Bourne, it would be quite literal. She'd come after you with, a machete.
I'm going to quit while I'm not too far behind.
Those are great movies. I saw it, it was on some rerun the other night. Really? None of them?
They're
mindless, fun, shoot 'em up.
Yeah.
Car chase.
Blockbuster explosions. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We can use some of that mindless diversion in light of many depressing things happening in our country. But I missed the chance to talk about the Republican National Convention last week. I was on vacation.
There was a Republican National Convention this week?
Yes. I was in a house full of people planning to vote for Trump. So I was having my own struggles.
Existential crisis?
Yes. That's okay. Thank you for that word.
Sure.
But we are going to have a chance to talk with the Democrats today. So let's get started. I think we are now calling this Ed Reform Update. Bump, bada, bada, bump, bada, bump, 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 bump. Did anybody do my song last week?
No.
Okay. The staff is starting to treat me like we always treated Checker. You guys are just ignoring my various ideas that you don't like. They just disappear.
Who told him?
What happened to getting that song from Weekend Update? Okay. First topic, and yes, I'm biased because this is something I wrote about, the enrichment gap. I had a piece last week in the 74.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, Robert. So basically pointing out, like Robert Putnam has done and others have done, that we do have in this country this big enrichment gap, meaning that affluent kids are doing all kinds of things after school on the weekends during the summer that poor kids don't get to do. And the affluent kids' parents are spending a fortune on this stuff.
Let me see you and raise you one. You know what the problem with this is? We have to stop thinking about this as an enrichment gap and start thinking of it as a literacy gap.
All right.
How many times have you heard me say this?
Okay? We've played this game before, Robert. Here it is. It's like Pundisio Go.
I had a nickel for every time.
Every cognitive input that a child has from the day he or she comes home to from the hospital to the day he sits down in front of that eighth grade test builds literacy, builds background knowledge, builds vocabulary. Yeah. So this is not... When you say enrichment, it sounds like, oh, that's fluffy extra stuff. No, this is the stuff.
Well, no, okay, yeah, Alyssa.
Yes, I can see where, activities like soccer and French lessons and Hebrew lessons and music lessons can feed They feed a literacy gap, but they also feed a larger gap as well, which goes into this larger point Mike's making about enrichment. Like, you learn the social interactions, you learn social cues, you learn how to have conversations with adults. Like, there are other things than just the literacy. Robert, I can't help you with that at this point.
It's too late.
Right.
But there are other things. It's literacy plus, I would argue,
that's being fed
by these programs. And
I'm making a very basic point. When you use the word enrichment, it sounds like extra. It's not extra.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it's the non-cognitive stuff. I mean, look, this was on my mind as we have been thick in the middle of summer swim season at the Petrilli household. And my second grader has been doing great. But you see this. Here he is, swim practice every day, going to the meets. Mm-hmm. And first of all, the grit and the perseverance, but also, seeing these older kids, the coaches are all these teenagers they look up to. They do these cheers. They have team spirit. It is social capital up the wazoo, right? And I feel very fortunate and blessed that my kids get to have these experiences, and it's swimming and it's soccer and it's on and on and on and on and on. And when you look at the data, it's just very clear that poor kids do not have access to these same things. Now, look, this is not news. And some people would argue that, hey, the poor kids at least get to have a more idyllic childhood in a way. Right.
LaRoe, call your
service.
Right.
Annette LaRoe. No, this is the argument. Because they're not overscheduled like the rich kids are. Right. They actually go outside and play. Still, they actually
develop independence.
And there is something to be said for that in that, know, Nat LeRoy would argue that as a result, these kids grow up to be, they're not as much kind of as a jerk. You know, there's
they have
helicopter parenting.
But what they lack is the ability, I think this was LeRoy's description, they lack some of the ability to navigate the adult world the way, and she had a phrase for this. There was concerted cultivation, which is what you're describing, and then there was it naturalistic childhood,
Though, is this quote-unquote naturalistic childhood? Like, sure, if they're living in the middle of Vermont by a pond and they're getting to live out some Walden fantasy every day, like, maybe that's a naturalistic childhood. But if they have these cultural deficits and they're living in an inner city community or they're living in a place where it's not safe to go wandering the streets for 6 hours, like, I'm not that's sure true. That's
then what are they doing? They're inside playing video games and...
They're outside playing Pokemon Go.
Or they're outside playing Pokemon Go. Hey, that would actually build some literacy, probably, among other things. Okay, so check out the piece. It's got some ideas in there. What can we do, including my proposal for enrichment savings accounts?
Interesting idea. Check it out.
Okay, now we also have promised our listeners that we'll talk about Democrats. So the Democrats having their big convention. Most of the coverage so far has been about some of the dissent still between the Bernie fans and the Hillary fans. The first night of the convention, though, big speeches, Michelle Obama among them. You know, also education reform hero Cory Booker with the big impassioned speech.
He'd written the VP speech anyway.
He had. So here's a question is, you know, are the Democrats going soft on ed reform?
Is everybody going soft on ed reform?
We talked about Republicans last week, Robert. Right. So we're talking about Democrats this week. What's your take on this? If Hillary is the next president, is she going to be less reformy than President Obama has been?
I think the signs certainly point to something that's more, I guess, quote unquote, traditional in terms of like her ed reform, traditionally progressive in terms of her ed reform stances. There's a lot more, you know, working closely with the unions. Randy Weingarten came out and endorsed Hillary right out of the gate.
So did the NEA, right?
Yeah. Right. And there's just kind of this return to, you know, maybe we don't need as much testing. Maybe we don't need all of these teacher evals. I see that as, if you look into the crystal ball, I see that as kind of what's in the future should Hillary win in November.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want this to sound cynical, but it feels to me like the Democrats bowed to Bernie and threw education under the bus in their platform.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I don't know if it matters that much, though.
Correct.
Okay, and this is why. Look, because of ESSA getting passed last year, right? It is, you know, we're well into implementation in terms of the regulations and all of that. If it is Hillary, I just don't think there's a ton to be done on K-12. She's going to be mostly focused on this higher ed proposal, free college, and on pre-K and pushing on that front. I think on K-12, look, there's still issues. There will be implementation issues. Sure. There will be Office for Civil Rights issues. I think most of those issues, though, break more along the lines of what do you think the appropriate federal role is?
Sure.
Versus reformy versus not reformy.
Right.
Now, look, there's going to be some specific things like take what's happening in California. California decided to move ahead and put forward an accountability plan even before the regs are done. Mm-hmm. And they've got this dashboard where it's this lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yes, yes.
All these colors. Right. Yeah. Wait, what'd you call it?
Data Schmeda, I think, is Governor Brown's approach to accountability.
I thought it was like the TSA alert system.
And as LA Times editorial board said, look, you can understand that No Child Left Behind got it wrong in the other direction. You know, coming down with one metric that wasn't very useful. This goes too far in the other direction of having so much information that, you know, it doesn't ever come right out and say to a parent, you know what, your school sucks. In a way that a rating system that might have an F on a school would be very
one of those
clear.
64 colors means your school sucks.
Yes, if you could decipher it.
I think it's the cornflower balloon.
So, you know, here's a question. Will the Obama administration allow something like this? I think they'll probably try not to as they finish up their regulations. Would a Clinton administration be okay with it? Well, it was designed by Linda Darling Hammond. It's the stuff the unions are pushing, maybe.
Yeah, we're never going to know. She's not going to win.
All right, but look at how picayune we're talking about. I mean, these are really, really in the weeds kinds of issues. I think the bottom line is on big picture stuff on, you know, are we going to move forward with charter schools? Is there still going to be testing? Is there still going to be discussions about accountability? I think the president's not going to matter very much.
Yep.
And of course, if it's Trump and, you know, he's starting a nuclear Armageddon, all these issues are coming off the table.
Oh my God. All right.
Hey, okay. I had to sneak that in there, Robert.
Yes, I'm Hillary Clinton.
All right, good. That was Ed Reform Update. Now it's time for everyone's favorite Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, I'm the only one here who's watched the Jason Bourne movies. Have you watched them?
I watched them a while back. I mean, like, I think the first one when, you know, Matt, which
Damon, Damon. Yeah.
I think I watched the initial one.
Okay. But they're all the same, right?
Which was good. Well, they are similar plots. Let me guess.
Gunshots, car chases, all explosions, right. Roll credits.
And yes.
He's a nice looking young man. He's easy on the eye. So, you know, women don't mind.
And he's an expert in education reform. You know that.
And he is an expert.
His mama was a teacher or is a teacher still, I guess. Yeah, all that.
All right. So, what you got for us, Amber, she is an expert on education.
She's such a huge expert. We got a new study out in AEFP Journal for the uninitiated. What is that? You guys know?
Ed Finance and Policy.
Association for Education, Finance, and Policy. Go ahead with your boom.
Boom.
Boom. That examines whether weighting AP courses promotes more AP course taking. Okay.
Say that again.
Whether weighting AP courses, okay, giving them more weight.
Right.
In
your GPA.
That's right. promotes. We're on the same board now. Promotes more AP course taking.
Yes.
Okay. The authors conduct a survey of over 900 traditional public schools in the great state of Texas. Mm-hmm. We're inquiring whether they had a weighting system for AP, when it was started, what changes have occurred in that system, and when. They literally called these schools up, which, wow that's rough. But anyway, 28 schools that had increased their weights comprised the treatment group and include rural, urban, and suburban schools dispersed across the state. Okay. Mm-hmm. The control group are drawn from a group, again, of traditional public schools with school level data available before any weight changes occurred at the study schools. And then they winnow the control schools down based on their geographic proximity to the treatment schools. They match them on a bunch of variables like number of AP courses, number of 12th graders, percent of students on free reduced lunch, so on and so forth. Once they're matched, then they verify where they're comparable at the student level. So they start looking at prior reading and test scores for the year preceding the weight change. Okay.
I'm with
so
you.
A bunch of methods, all because they want to make sure they have baseline equivalence.
Right.
Okay. We're all good. So between 1999 and 2008, they follow 8 cohorts of 10th graders through grade 12 at the schools that change their weights and at the match comparison schools. And they're looking at change over time for both groups.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. You guys are following me in all the methods.
Yeah,
a lot of findings. They raise the magnitude of the AP for schools that raise the magnitude of the weight of the AP weight in schools that already use weights. Okay. They already been doing it. It had a very small impact, mostly limited to the white kids who were not eligible for reduced price lunch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Huh. We shall, from here on, call these the grade grubbers.
I was just going to say, right? This is the grade grubbing study.
A term not used in the AEFP journal.
Okay.
Yes. Anyhow, when schools...
This is what's wrong with those journal articles. If this was a Fordham study, we would have used that
term. We negotiate that term, Mike.
In the foreword.
When schools introduce weights for the very first time, the impact is significant and widespread. Okay. So the probability of taking an AP course increases by 3 to 12%, and the number of AP courses taken increased by 0.10 to 0.95 standard deviation.
And then they realize, hey, these are really hard courses.
With the largest impacts reserved for those, again, who are not eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Yeah. But then we look at the ones who are eligible. Okay. For the low income kids, there are still impacts. So it's not, you know, moot for them. So for Black, Hispanic, and white students who are eligible for the low price lunch, increased course taking increased by 0.10 to 0.13 courses. Mm-hmm. So that's not, you know, that's something.
Yeah, a modest effect.
Kids respond to incentives.
Right. So in terms of the longitudinal trends, and I thought this was a great summary, so it's in quotes, our results indicate that grade weights can generate a one-time increase in AP participation rates, but a ratcheting up of weights after this initial introduction essentially serves as a reward for students who would have taken the courses anyway. That's their
stuff.
And then they talk about, you know, we need to bolster outreach to low-income families to make sure they understand the potentials of taking AP courses.
Well, outreach, but also preparation.
Preparation.
So that's good. I mean, it's interesting that it seems to indicate that kids, they care about their GPAs, and I assume that that's partly because they care about their class rank.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this weighting thing, I assume that don't most colleges now, the selective colleges, have their own way of weighting these sorts of things, right?
So.
I mean,
yep,
they will decide on their own
process.
How to standardize this stuff. And whether they provide extra weights
or not. And kids know, I think, even if they don't pass the AP course, they know it signals something to a college when they see the stuff on their transcript.
I was just going to say, might it not have been a better approach for the study to look at intent to attend college rather than merely free and reduced price lunch?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the more likely you are, if you're in 10th grade and you see yourself as college bound, you're more likely to do this with waiting than if you do not see yourself as a college teacher.
That's really like the researcher goes, how would you get that
maybe
variable?
If you took the PSAT?
You'd have to poll.
You'd have to, maybe they have that on the PSAT. Yeah.
Oh, so here's a similar study that either they should do, we should do, somebody should do, right, about student incentives. These policies that have been in the news lately about how teachers are no longer allowed to give a zero on an exam or an assignment.
They can only give 50. 50
or 60. It's ridiculous, right? But I've been arguing in the press that says, well, kids are going to figure this out. And so they're going to not turn in assignments or they're going to
do it half.
It would be, let's check this empirically. Let's see, how do kids respond to these new systems?
But you know, that was going on even when there's no written policy. I mean, Robert, I'm sure you've seen some of this. You know, there's kind of an understanding that, you know, you just don't do it. I mean, my principal used to say back in the day, well, I mean, how are they ever going to catch up? You know, if you give them a zero,
zero, that's the wake up call. Oh, you want to retake the exam? You want to turn in the paper? Sure. And if you don't, the zero stands.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Boom.
Easy.
There it is.
I mean, even that's a little unfair, though, isn't it? I don't know.
No,
it's so hard.
I'm pretty strict on these things, but the goal is not to assign a grade punitively. The goal is to accomplish.
Have to learn something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course.
But do you announce to the class like this is the policy here?
I kind of figure it out. As a teacher, I always basically, there's no such thing, at least for a paper, as a final grade. You get your feedback. Until we run out of school year, you always have the opportunity
to
go back.
You see it as learning. I like that. I think it's
And my understanding is that was the policy Socrates had back in the day as well. And I think if it worked back then.
You read him a lot, Mike.
it's in one of his more obscure works where he goes into his grading policy.
Final exam. That was summative.
All right. Good stuff. Very relevant.
I thought it was
good. Course, I'm always the question, how are we going to get this news out to high schools across the country?
They're not reading AEFP journals.
They're listening to Amber's research minute.
I hope they are. Hey, and speaking of which, more should be doing so. So everybody listening right now, tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. You would be surprised at people who don't know it exists.
That's right.
Build them in. Don't let it be a secret. All right. Thanks, everybody. That is all the time we got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Robert Pundicio.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.